but in truth, that often results in making a jerk out of yourself. I remembered that my father and mother had told me to speak less in such situations. The less you say, the more you'll likely hear. They were warning me. Given my predisposition for dominating a conversation from an early age. That's the way you learn from others, Dad said, and glean the small nuances that will help you engender a deeper relationship later on. There's also no better way to signal your interest in becoming a mentee. People tacitly notice your respect and are flattered by the attention. That said, quiet for me isn't exactly quiet. I asked tons of questions, suggested things that I saw from the summer, and conspired with these leaders of the firm on what was important to them, making the firm a success. Mentoring is a very deliberate activity that requires people to check their ego at the door, hold back from resenting other people's success, and consciously strive to build beneficial relationships whenever the opportunity arises. Other interns at that party looked at Pat and the other senior partners with intimidation and boredom. What do I have in common with them? And therefore kept their distance. They looked at their job titles versus the bigwigs and felt excluded. And because of it, they were. When I finally graduated from school in typical MBA fashion, I interviewed with several companies. My choice was coming down to Deloitte Consulting and one of their competitors, McKinsey. McKinsey was then considered the gold standard of consulting companies. For most of my peers, the choice would have been obvious. Then one afternoon, I got a call the day before my final McKinsey interview. When I picked up the phone, I was met with a familiar, gruff voice. Accept our offer now, and you can come down to New York for dinner this evening with me and some of my partners. Before I had a chance to respond, he said, It's Pat Licato. I want to know if you're coming to Deloitte or not. I told Pat, uncomfortably, that I hadn't decided on where I'd end up, but I had an idea that might help me through the process. Listen, I'm still up in the air, I told him. But it would help if I had dinner with you and a few partners to get a better feel for what I'd be doing and where the organization is headed. I'll have dinner with you only if you accept my offer, he said. Pat was joking again, and I liked him even more for his unorthodox recruiting practices. Then he let me off the hook with, Okay, get your butt down to New York, and don't worry. We'll get you out to Chicago in the morning for your interview. Now, how did he know about my interview? So I found myself with Pat and a few partners around a table at Grifone, their favorite Italian restaurant in Manhattan. The banter was hard and heavy, as was the drinking. We had gone through bottles and bottles of great wine and a few cognacs on top of that. Near the end of dinner, Pat threw out his pitch and actually launched into a fairly shocking tirade. Who the hell do you think you are? You think McKinsey gives a damn about Keith Ferrazzi? Before I could answer, he continued. You think the CEO of McKinsey knows who you are? You think any of the senior partners would take a Sunday night to have dinner with you? You'll be just another number-crunching MBA grad lost in the shuffle. We care about you. We want you to be successful here. More importantly, we think you can make a difference in our firm. Was I in? Pat demanded to know. Wow. His pitch was compelling, and right then my instinct told me he was right. I knew he was right, but I wasn't about to leave that dinner without making a small pitch of my own. Look, I'll make you a deal, I said. If I accept your offer, all I ask is that you give me 3 dinners a year at this very restaurant for as long as I'm at Deloitte. I'm in if you're in. He looked me in the eyes, and then with the biggest smile said, Great. Welcome to Deloitte. By the way, I then asked him for more money. He just shook his head and laughed. Well, it never hurts to ask. The worst he could have said was no. So after 3 hours in a restaurant, this man convinced me to make a life-changing career decision without one word about title, salary, or even one detail of how he expected I might make a difference. Honestly, I still had my doubts at the beginning that I had made the right move. In consulting, Deloitte's was smaller potatoes those days. Its prestige didn't compare with McKinsey's. But what a right move I had made. In fact, it was the best of my life. First, because I went to Deloitte Consulting, I was given more responsibilities, and I learned more about consulting in the 8 years that followed than most people learn in 20. Second, I found I could make a difference given my access to the senior partners. Third, and most important, I realized that finding a talented, experienced mentor who is willing to invest the time and effort to develop you as a person and a professional is far more important than making career decisions based purely on salary or prestige. Besides, back then the money wasn't important. You learn in your 20s, as the saying goes, and earn in your 30s. And boy, did I ever learn. Each year, Pat and I had at least 3 dinners at Grifone, that same Italian restaurant. For my entire tenure at Deloitte, I had the ear of the CEO, and he kept asking about me among his partners. He was looking out for me the entire time. Ultimately, of course, I got to work closely with Pat and other amazing men and women at Deloitte, and it taught me the importance of attaching yourself to great people, great teachers. Not that working with Pat and his right-hand man, Bob Kirk, was easy. They taught me some hard lessons about staying focused, that bold ideas weren't enough if they couldn't be executed. The details are as significant as the theories, that you had to put people first, all people, not just those above you. Pat probably should have fired me a few times. Instead, he invested time and energy into making me the kind of executive, and more important, the kind of leader, he wanted me to be, for the sake of the firm and for the sake of his role as mentor. There were two crucial components that made my mentorship with Pat, and that make any mentorship, for that matter, successful. He offered his guidance because, for one, I promised something in return. I worked nonstop in an effort to use the knowledge he was imparting to make him and his firm more successful. And two, we created a situation that went beyond utility. Pat liked me and became emotionally invested in my advancement. He cared about me. That's the key to a successful mentorship. A successful mentoring relationship needs equal parts utility and emotion. You can't simply ask somebody to be personally invested in you. There has to be some reciprocity involved, whether it's hard work or loyalty, that you give in return, that gets someone to invest in you in the first place. Then, when the process kicks in, you have to mold your mentor into a coach, someone for whom your success is in some small or big way his success. I owe so much to Pat. If it were not for him, I would not be the man I am today. And that goes for so many others, starting with my mom and dad, and Jack Pigeon from the Kiske School, and my uncle Bob Wilson, to so many others I've mentioned in this book, as well as those left unmentioned, but to whom I feel so close. The best way to approach utility is to give help first and not ask for it. If there is someone whose knowledge you need, find a way to be of use to that person. Consider their needs and how you can assist them. If you can't help them specifically, perhaps you can contribute to their charity, company, or community. You have to be prepared to give back to your mentors and have them know that from the outset. Before Pat would consider having dinner with me 3 times a year, he had to know that I would be committed to his firm, That's how I found myself so early on, in a trusted position that later turned into a friendship. If, however, there are no immediate opportunities to help, you must be prudent and conscious of the imposition you're placing on that person. Almost every day, some ambitious young man or woman sends me an email that states, all too directly, I want a job, or I think you can help me. Take me on as your mentee. I shudder at how deeply these young folks misunderstand the process. If they're going to get my help, and they haven't even offered their help in return, then at minimum they should attempt to endear themselves to me. Tell me why you're special. Tell me what we have in common. Express gratitude, excitement, and passion. The problem is, often, that these people have never had mentors before, and they have a limited view of how it works. Some people think there is just one special person out there waiting to be all things at all times to them. But as my father taught me, mentors are all around you. It's not necessarily your boss or even someone in your business. Mentoring is a non-hierarchical activity that transcends careers and can cross all organizational levels. A CEO can learn from a manager, and vice versa. Some smart companies, recognizing this fact, actually have programs in place that view new hires as mentors to the company. After a month on the job, they'll ask these new employees to jot down all their impressions, with the idea that a pair of fresh eyes can see old problems and make innovative suggestions that others can't. In fact, the people I've learned so much from are my own young mentees, who help me periodically to update my skills and view the world anew. As much as you stretch yourself by reaching up, be sure you are stretching just as far to reach back and help others. I've always taken the time to give young people a helping hand. Most of them actually end up working for me at some point, either as interns or employees. People like Paul Lussow, Chad Hodge, Hani Abizade, Andy Bone, Brinda Chugani, Anna Mongate, John Lux, Jason Annis. The list goes on and on. There are those who don't get it at first. They sheepishly ask, how can I ever repay you for all that you are doing? I tell them they're repaying me now. All I really expect is sincere gratitude and to see them apply all that they are learning. To see Brinda moving up at Deloitte, Hani becoming a partner at one of my businesses, and graduating into a new company I had a hand in forming, Chad becoming one of Hollywood's most successful young writers, Andy becoming a player in Hollywood himself, or Paul attending Wharton, is a total thrill. It's even more so when they get to a point in their careers when they start becoming mentors themselves. I can't stress enough how powerful the process is and how important it is that you give your respect and time to it. In return, you'll be more than compensated with spirit, enthusiasm, trust, and empathy, all things that will ultimately far exceed the value of any advice you give. If you take mentoring seriously and give it the time and energy it deserves, you'll soon find yourself involved in a learning network not unlike the one Intel uses. You'll be the recipient of more information and more goodwill than you ever imagined, as you play the role of both master and apprentice in a powerful constellation of people all simultaneously teaching and being taught. Connector's Hall of Fame Profile. Eleanor Roosevelt, 1884 to 1962. Connecting should advance rather than compromise your principles. If connecting can be described loosely as the co-mingling of friendship and mission, then First Lady Eleanor Roosevelt was one of the 20th century's premier practitioners. In her autobiography, she wrote, "Being drawn together through the work is one of the most satisfying ways of making and keeping friends. Through groups such as the International Congress of Working Women and the Women's International League of Peace and Freedom, WILPF. Roosevelt befriended a wide circle of friends and a few foes in advancing some of the great social causes of our time. The First Lady was not timid about using her personal network to tackle testy social issues. For example, she fought for women's rights in the workplace, their inclusion in labor unions, and their right to a living wage. Today, those seem like uncontroversial issues, but during the late 1920s and early 1930s, many Americans blamed working women for displacing male breadwinners in the midst of the Great Depression. Roosevelt believed the beauty and obligation of living in a democracy was to make a stand for what you believe in, and she proved you could do so while gaining the trust and admiration of your peers. She also proved that sometimes it was your peers whom you need to stand up against. In 1936, thanks largely to the First Lady, an opera singer named Marian Anderson became the first black person to perform at the White House. But Anderson's acceptance at 1600 Pennsylvania Avenue was unusual. Though Anderson was the country's third highest concert box office draw, her success did not exempt her from the racial biases that pervaded her era. When traveling, she was restricted to colored waiting rooms, hotels, and train cars. In the South, newspapers rarely called her Miss Anderson, opting for Artist Anderson and Singer Anderson instead. In 1939, Anderson's manager and Howard University tried to arrange a performance at Constitution Hall in Washington, D.C. The Daughters of the American Revolution, DAR, the organization that owned the hall, refused them. Roosevelt, herself a member of the DAR, promptly and publicly resigned her membership to protest. In a letter to the DAR, she wrote, "I am in complete disagreement with the attitude taken in refusing Constitution Hall to a great artist. You had an opportunity to lead in an enlightened way, and it seems to me that your organization has failed." Mrs. Roosevelt arranged for Anderson to perform on the steps of the Lincoln Memorial, the show on April 9th, Easter Sunday, 1939, was seen by a crowd of 75,000. Yes, loyalty matters, but not when it means sacrificing your principles. Though Eleanor Roosevelt's positions on civil rights hardly seem radical today, they were far in advance of her time. All of this was decades before the Supreme Court, in its 1954 Brown v. Board of Education case, rejected the separate but equal doctrine. Every time the First Lady advocated for a social cause, preached tolerance in a black church or Jewish temple, and even when acting as a delegate to the newly formed United Nations, which passed the controversial Universal Declaration of Human Rights, she lost friends and received vicious criticism for going against the tide. Still, this amazing woman persisted in successfully building influence for a progressive agenda. She left a legacy to which we are all indebted. What can we learn from Eleanor Roosevelt? It's not enough simply to reach out to others. Instead, we all must be vigilant that our efforts to bring people together are in line with our efforts to, in part, make the world a better place. Of course, when you're driven by principles, there are always sacrifices involved. But your determination to connect with others should never come at the expense of your values. In fact, your network of colleagues and friends, if chosen wisely, can help you fight for causes you believe in. Chapter 32. Balance is BS. Balance is a myth. You can't call my schedule balanced by conventional standards, Let's take a look at a typical day. Monday. I was up at 4 a.m. in Los Angeles to make calls to my team in New York. Then I worked the phone for a few more hours, trying to organize a fundraiser for a candidate friend of mine. By 7 a.m., I was at the airport for a flight to Portland, Oregon, to meet a new customer. With two cell phones buzzing, fidgeting with my BlackBerry, sending short emails, and my laptop never far away with spreadsheet access. After the meeting, I'm back in the car on my way to Seattle, and back on the phone, setting up meetings for tonight, tomorrow, and a week from now. I'm in constant contact with my assistant, trying to get invitations out for a big dinner party I'm throwing in a month. In Seattle, I have a scheduled dinner with the folks organizing Bill Gates' CEO conference this year, after which I'll have drinks with some close friends. And tomorrow, there will be another 4 a.m. wake-up call to do it all again. Welcome to what my friends jokingly refer to as Ferrazzi time, a zone of operations in which the switchboards are always open and the rush of humanity is ongoing. Witnessing such a schedule begs a number of very important questions. Is this a life? Operating in such a way, can one have balance between work and having a life? And do you, God forbid, have to operate in Ferrazzi time to be successful? The answers are, yes, it is a life, albeit my own. Yes, you can find balance, albeit your own. And no, thank heavens, you don't have to do it my way. For me, the best thing about a relationship-driven career is that it isn't a career at all. It's a way of living. Several years ago, I started to realize that connecting was actually a way of seeing the world. When I thought and behaved in that way, dividing my life between professional and personal spheres no longer made sense. I realized what made you successful in both worlds were other people and the way you related to them. Whether those people were family people, work people, or friend people, real connecting insists that you bring the same values to every relationship. As a result, I no longer needed to make a distinction between my career happiness and my life happiness. They were both pieces of me, my life. When it became clear to me that the key to my life was the relationships in it, I found there was no longer a need to compartmentalize work from, say, family or friends. I could spend my birthday at a business conference and be surrounded with warm and wonderful friends, as I recently did. Or I could be at home in Los Angeles or New York with equally close friends to celebrate. The kind of false idea of balance is some sort of equation that you could take this many hours from one side of your life and give it to this other side, flew out the window. And with it went all the stress of trying to achieve that perfect state of equilibrium we reach and hear so much about. Balance can't be bought or sold. It doesn't need to be implemented. Balance is a mindset, as individual and unique as our genetic code. Where you find joy, you find balance. My wacky schedule works for me, and perhaps only for me. The blurring of professional and personal lives isn't for everyone. The important thing is to see connecting with others not just as another manipulative tool used toward achieving a goal, but rather as a way of life. When you're out of balance, you'll know because you'll be rushed, angry, and unfulfilled. When you're balanced, you'll be joyful, enthusiastic, and full of gratitude. Don't worry about trying to develop your own version of Ferrazzi time. The way you reach out to others is the way you eat an 800-pound gorilla, one small bite at a time. In the end, we all live one life, and that life is all about the people we live it with. More people. More balance. If you buy into the myth of balance, the one that sees life as an equation, as I once did, the answers to such questions as, if I'm so accomplished, why aren't I having more fun? Or, if I'm so organized, why do I feel so out of control? Is to simplify, compartmentalize, or reduce your life into its most essential components. So we try to save time by eating our lunches at our desk. We have less serendipitous conversations with colleagues, strangers, and other non-essentials at the water cooler. We consolidate our schedules to include only the most important actions. People tell us, if you just get more organized, if you strike a balance between work and home and limit yourself to the important people in your life, you'll feel better. That's just totally misguided. What they should have been saying is, I gotta get a life filled with people I love. The problem, as I see it, isn't what you're working on, it's whom you're working with. You can't feel in love with your life if you hate your work, and more times than not, people don't love their work because they work with people they don't like. Connecting with others doubles and triples your opportunities to meet with people who can lead to a new and exciting job. I think the problem in today's world isn't that we have too many people in our lives, it's that we don't have enough. Dr. Will Miller and Glenn Sparks, in their book, Refrigerator Rights, Creating Connections and Restoring Relationships, argue that with our increased mobility, American emphasis on individualism, and the overwhelming online distractions available to us, we lead lives of relative isolation. How many people can walk into our homes and just open up the fridge and help themselves? Not many. People need refrigerator rights relationships. The kind that are comfortable, informal, and intimate enough to let us walk into one another's kitchens and rummage through the refrigerator without asking. It is close relationships like these that keep us well-adjusted, happy, and successful. America's focus on individualism works against reaching out to others. Comparative studies on levels of job stress and worker dissatisfaction show that people of individualistic cultures typically report much higher stress levels than do people who work in more community-oriented cultures. In spite of our high standard of living, wealth and privilege haven't produced emotional well-being. Instead, as these studies show, it's a sense of belonging that brings us happiness. When our lonely lives catch up with us, we turn to self-help literature for answers. But it isn't self-help we need. I'd argue, it's help from others. If you buy this, and I hope that you do, then what I teach in this book is the perfect antidote to all this talk of imbalance. Connecting is that rare thing that lets us have our cake and eat it too. We end up serving the interests of both our work and our life, ourselves and others. Oscar Wilde once suggested that if people did what they loved, it would feel as if they never worked a day in their life. If your life is filled with people you care about and who care for you, why concern yourself with balancing anything at all? Chapter 33. Welcome to the Connected Age. The Dalai Lama said, "We human beings are social beings. We come into the world as the result of others' actions. We survive here in dependence on others. Whether we like it or not, there is hardly a moment in our lives when we do not benefit from others' activities. For this reason, it is hardly surprising that most of our happiness arises in the context of our relationships with others." There has never been a better time to reach out and connect than right now. The dynamic of our society, and particularly our economy, will increasingly be defined by interdependence and interconnectivity. In other words, the more everything becomes connected to everything and everyone else, the more we begin to depend on whom and what we're connected with. Rugged individualism may have ruled for much of the 19th and 20th century, but community and alliances will rule in the 21st century. In the digital era, when the internet has broken down geographic boundaries and connected hundreds of millions of people and computers around the world, there's no reason to live and work in isolation. We've come to realize, again, that success is not contingent on cool technology or venture capital. It's dependent on whom you know and how you work with them. We've rediscovered that the real key to profit is working well with other people. The truth of this is powerfully illustrated in a 1986 study commissioned by Harvard's then-president Derek Bok. Bok wanted to know if there was a way to predict whether a kid would succeed or fail in college. What was different about those who kicked ass as undergrads? A large-scale study was conducted over the course of several years. One finding in particular surprised everyone. The single best predictor of college success had nothing to do with any metric we associate with collegiate achievement, now or then. It wasn't GPA, SAT scores, or a number of any kind for that matter. It was instead the ability of a student to create or join a study group. Kids who studied in groups, even only once a week, were more engaged in their studies, were better prepared for class, and learned significantly more than students who worked on their own. They even had more fun. Nothing else even remotely approached the power of that single variable in explaining college success. The key to college success is now the key to professional success of just about any kind. Learning is best achieved through relationships. Having the right conversations with the right people in the right context. And collaborative action. Nothing is more important today than having a people-powered infrastructure, freed from the constraints of time and space by technology, to provide you with a flow of opportunities and lifelong learning. Revolutions begin in unlikely places. Life is about work, work is about life, and both are about people. The most exciting breakthrough of the 21st century will occur not because of technology, but because of an expanding concept of what it means to be human, said the futurist John Nesbitt. We are in the formative stages of a new era of connectivity and community. We now have the skills and knowledge to thrive in this environment. But to what end? How will you thrive? What does it mean to live a truly connected life? Certainly, some of us will tally success in terms of income and promotions. Others will cite their newfound celebrity or the exciting expertise that they've amassed. For others still, it will be the fabulous dinner parties they throw or the aspirational contacts they've befriended. But will such success feel empty? Instead of being surrounded by a loving family and a trusted circle of friends, will you only have colleagues and clients? Sooner or later, in one way or another, we will all ask ourselves these questions. Moreover, we'll look back on our life and wonder, what is my legacy? What have I done that is meaningful? How many of you can recall the names of the last three CEOs of General Motors, IBM, or Walmart? Are you struggling to come up with names? Now try and recall three important figures in the civil rights movement. And here, people usually can name six or more. Ultimately, making your mark as a connector means making a contribution to your friends and family, to your company, to your community, and most important, to the world, by making the best use of your contacts and talents. It's funny what events in life will make you question where you're headed and what you value most. I remember as a young man, for instance, dreaming of owning my own Brooks Brothers button-down shirt. All throughout my years growing up, I wore hand-me-downs from my mom's cleaning customers' kids. Or I'd find my clothes in secondhand thrift shops. I thought that when the day came that I could walk into a shop like Brooks Brothers and buy my own first-hand shirt for retail, well, that would be the day I arrived. That day came. I was in my mid-20s, and I proudly bought the finest, most expensive button-down shirt Brooks Brothers sold. The next day, I wore that shirt into work as if it were a rare, emerald-studded gown from the Victorian era. Then I washed it. I remember pulling my shirt from the washer and, gasp, 2 buttons had fallen off. I kid you not. This, I asked myself, is what I've been waiting for all my life? As noted author and speaker Rabbi Harold Kushner once wisely wrote, "Our souls are not hungry for fame, comfort, wealth, or power. Those rewards create almost as many problems as they solve. Our souls are hungry for meaning, for the sense that we have figured out how to live so that our lives matter, so the world will at least be a little bit different for our having passed through it." But it would take many more missing buttons before I truly started to ask myself what meaning exactly my soul was hungry for. That time finally came with what I call my own personal mini-revolution. Revolutions sometimes begin in the least likely of places, with the least likely of heroes. Who could imagine that a small Indian man with a very strong accent could challenge what I wanted out of life and how I was going to attain it? Or that doing nothing and remaining silent for 10 days, rather than trying to do everything all at once, could change the course of my life? The first shot in my revolution happened while I was in Switzerland, of all places, for the World Economic Forum, attending an oversubscribed talk entitled simply, "Happiness." The room was jam-packed with the world's rich and powerful, a clear indication that there were others in my midst who had experienced a few missing buttons of their own. We were gathered together to hear a short, stout, and thoroughly happy-looking man named S.N. Goenka deliver a speech on how he, as a businessman turned guru, found health and happiness through an ancient tradition of meditation known as Vipassana. Goenka slowly shuffled to the podium and launched into a talk that enraptured the entire audience for the next hour. With his words, we were all transported into our own heads, forced to confront the feelings of inadequacy, stress, and imbalance that still accompanied our seemingly successful lives. Not a word was spoken about business, per se. There was no talk of balance sheets or influential contacts. Happiness, he told us, had nothing to do with how much money we made or how we made it. There is only one place to find real peace, real harmony. That place is within, Goenka told us. And while we may be masters of business, it was clear that we were not masters of our own minds and souls. There was a way, he said, to ask the right questions and become masters of our mind. Vipassana, we were told, is an insight meditation technique that means to see things as they really are. It was a technology for inner peace that could drive fear from the heart and help us have the courage to be who we really are. Goenka described a grueling 10-day course, during which practitioners sit for hours-long stretches in absolute silence, without eye contact, writing, or communication of any kind, except with teachers at the end of each day. It was up to us. No, it was within us to live a happy and meaningful life. We just had to ask the right questions and spend the time looking and listening. While I'm not sure how many of my fellow executives were intent on learning Vipassana, it was clear that Goenka had touched us, deeply. He made us feel, at least for that moment, that we had the power to make our work and lives mean something, that it could be important, that it could make a difference, and that we could learn to be happy if only we took the time to listen to what our souls were telling us. I left refreshed and inspired, but I was sure that I would never learn Vipassana. 10 days with no conference calls, no power lunches, no talking, 10 days. Impossible. I could never find the time. Then suddenly, I had all the time in the world. After my departure from Starwood, one too many buttons had gone missing, and I was in need of clarity and happiness. Until that moment, I thought I didn't have enough time or courage for 10 days of introspection. But eventually I took the Vipassana course and learned, for what seemed the first time in my life, to slow down and truly listen. In the process, I shed many, though not all, of the thoughts of what I should and ought to be doing. If you commit yourself to finding your passion, that blue flame, it's interesting how that commitment is rewarded with answers. The questions that came to me after all that meditation helped me to reevaluate my pursuit of prestige and money and refocus on what I've always known matters most. Relationships. Vipassana certainly isn't the only way to get clarity. But so few of us give ourselves the time and space we need to come to a better understanding of who we are and what we really want. How had I, along with so many other perfectly capable and intelligent people I knew, allowed my life to get so far out of whack? By failing to ask ourselves the kinds of questions that are the most important. What is your passion? What truly gives you pleasure? How can you make a difference? When I left the meditation course and got back to the routine of my life, I was like a kid in a candy store. There were so many people I wanted to meet, so many people I wanted to help. The pursuit of achievement could be, I realized, so much fun and so inspiring when you knew what was worthy of achieving. We've been taught to see life as a quest, a journey that ends with, hopefully, meaning, love, and an IRA that will keep our golden years golden. There is, however, no end, no final arrival. The quest never quite ends. There is no one job title, or one Brooks Brothers shirt, or $1 amount that can ever act as the ultimate finishing line. Which is why the achievement of some goals can feel as disappointing as failure. Living a connected life leads one to take a different view. Life is less a quest than a quilt. We find meaning, love, and prosperity through the process of stitching together our bold attempts to help others find their own way in their lives. The relationships we weave become an exquisite and endless pattern. There is a line in a lovely movie called How to Make an American Quilt that sums up this philosophy nicely. Young lovers seek perfection. Old lovers sew shreds together and see beauty in the multiplicity of patches. What will be the legacy of your own quilt? How will you be remembered? These questions are potent measuring sticks for anyone who cares about making a difference, not just making a living. There's nothing wrong with wanting to be the best in the world, as long as you remember that doing so also means wanting to be the best for the world. Remember that love, reciprocity, and knowledge are not like bank accounts that grow smaller as you use them. Creativity begets more creativity. Money begets more money. Knowledge begets more knowledge. More friends beget more friends. Success begets even more success. Most important, giving begets giving. At no time in history has this law of abundance been more apparent than in this connected age, where the world increasingly functions in accord with networking principles. Wherever you are in life right now, and whatever you know, is a result of the ideas, experiences, and people you have interacted with in your life, whether in person, through books and music, email, or culture. There is no score to keep when abundance leads to even more abundance. So make a decision that from this day forward, you will start making the contacts and accumulating the knowledge, experiences, and people to help you achieve your goals. But first, be honest with yourself. How much time are you ready to spend on reaching out and giving before you get? How many mentors do you have? How many people have you mentored? What do you love to do? How do you want to live? Whom do you want to be part of your quilt? From my own experience, I can tell you the answers will come as a surprise. What's important probably won't come down to a job, a company, or a cool new piece of technology. It will come down to people. It's up to each of us, working together with people we love, to make the world a world we want to live in. As the anthropologist Margaret Mead once said, "Never doubt that a small group of thoughtful, committed citizens can change the world." Indeed, it is the only thing that ever has. It is my hope that you have the tools to make that a reality. But you can't do it alone. We are all in this together. Make your quilt count.
The end. You've been listening to Never Eat Alone and Other Secrets to Success, One Relationship at a Time, by Keith Ferrazzi with Tal Raz. Narrated by Richard Harries and directed by Ian McCulloch. If you've enjoyed this book and this performance, Recorded Books recommends Life is a Series of Presentations, 8 Ways to Punch Up Your People Skills at Work, at Home, Anytime, Anywhere, by Tony Geary, with Kim Dower and J.E. Fishman. Narrated by Rick Rowan. Tony Geary, known as Mr. Presentation, is coach to America's top CEOs. In this useful guide, Geary offers 8 ways in which to approach presentations with flair and confidence. Through anecdotes and lists of essential principles of presentation, all listeners will learn how to impress an audience. We also recommend The Power of Full Engagement. Managing energy, not time, is the key to performance, health, and happiness, by Tony Schwartz and Jim Lehrer, narrated by Richard Davidson. Tony Schwartz and Jim Lehrer deliver a revolutionary approach to success based on their belief that the key to ultimate performance lies not in managing time, but in managing energy. The author's program is built around the corporate athlete training system, which was developed from studies of the world's greatest athletes. The Power of Full Engagement is a life-changing experience for everyone from full-time parents to CEOs of Fortune 500 companies. Recorded Books offers a wide selection of bestsellers, mysteries, classics, histories, and more, so look for us at your public library or on download sites online, and thank you for being a Recorded Books reader.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.